Thank you, Michael. And it is, of course, a great pleasure for me to be able to do my bit tonight to celebrate PN Review, of which perhaps a little more later. I'm also grateful to you for all of you here tonight for having so manfully struggled, doubtless, with the widescreen TVs you've been lugging home on Black Friday while being pummeled by an angry crowd. So it's good to see you here too. Of course, PN Review is one of those absolutely vital conduits for the cross-traffic between new poetry and new criticism. It is essential reading, I think. It has been for many years. So great to see it having another new lease of life. But it's not another life, it's the same life, which is continuing and marvellous to see. Now, my lecture to mark this occasion is about the give and take between poetry and criticism, or the take and give. It's called The Quarrel with Ourselves. I want to consider that phrase, that fairly well-known statement about poetry and about the way we talk about things that include poetry. Many of you will recognise its author as being W.B. Yeats. We make out of the quarrel with others rhetoric, but of the quarrel with ourselves poetry. Unlike the rhetoricians who get a confident voice from remembering the crowd they have won or will win, we sing amid our uncertainty. And smitten, even in the presence of the most high beauty, by the knowledge of our solitude, our rhythm shudders. I've no idea how often the first sentence of this has been quoted over the years, but the figure must be a high one. Naturally, it's been quoted apart from its context. But pointing this out should not be taken for some game-winning production of the critical ace. If you read on, I think you'll find that what he really means is this and not what you're saying at all. Nevertheless, I will begin what I have to say with some information. Yeats's remarks come from his short prose book, Per Amica Silentia Lunae, which was written in 1917 and published simultaneously in London and New York on the 18th of January 1918. To translate those dates into the author's age, the work was written when Yeats was 51 and published when he was 52 years old. He'd been publishing poetry since he was 19 years of age and critical prose since he was 21. So his statement here has a good deal of time and experience behind it. Yeats, by this time, knew a few things, that is to say, about both poetry and quarrelling. Definitions of poetry are not very helpful things. At least, they're not at all helpful for the making of poetry. It won't help a poet to do a good job if she or he prepares to welcome the muse by reciting the mantras that poetry is at bottom a criticism of life, or that poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world. The reason for this is that any definition we care to provide is by its nature a nugget of critical thought and expression. And this goes for those pieces of critical theory masquerading as verse, such as the dogma that a poem should not mean but be. Hope you heard the line break there. Or many of the grander pronouncements in, say, the poems of Wallace Stevens. Wheelbarrows and plums, too, have been critically wheeled out and savoured, perhaps too much. Thinking we know what poetry is does not give us a way to write a poem, or to commit the contemporary critical sin of value judgment, it does not guarantee a good one. None of this is to deny that it's the business of critics to say, if they're lucky, to say memorably what they think poetry is. Implicitly, all worthwhile poetry criticism does this, however incrementally or subtly. But between critical thought and the ways in which the mechanisms of an achieved poem can be said to enact a kind of thought, there is a real and insuperable distinction. Distinctions can be blurred, of course. But a blurred distinction is simply one that is rendered unclear, not one that has been abolished. Criticism, like poetry, ought to be in the business of clarity. Good criticism makes clear what was otherwise indistinct, while a good poem puts something hitherto not merely indistinct but entirely non-existent into its own unique clarity of existence. Criticism necessarily talks in terms of things we know about, in however intellectually demanding a way. A really new poem, on the other hand, is something we never knew before, and which we had no means of imagining. Put like that, it might be difficult to see where any difficulties could possibly arise. Poems are poems, and criticism is criticism, and all is well. And yet, as Yeats and others in other times have known, the world is not like this. For both poetry and criticism have inherent tendencies to know what is best for each other. At its worst, that can result in the kind of poetry that disdains all possible readers in the name of its own unchallengeable authenticity, demanding only a criticism that has already passed the test of appreciating it. And the sort of criticism which either knows in advance what does and does not make a good poem, or then proceeds to assess poets and subjects in accordance with standards it insists upon as normative. Not that Yeats, you'll notice, says anything about criticism. Instead, he mentions the quarrel with others. And this goes further than mere disagreement on literary judgment. What is a quarrel? The OED offers two definitions which seem to cover Yeats's intended ground. It's 3A which first occurs to us, perhaps, a dispute or argument, a violent contention or altercation with another person or between persons, a disruption of friendly relations. This itself spans a good deal, for a disruption of friendly relations is one thing, and a violent contention quite another. There's also sense 2A to consider, a ground or occasion of complaint with, also against or to, a person, leading to hostile feeling, words or action, a reason for having or cause of unfriendly or unfavourable feelings towards another person, a state or feeling of hostility resulting from any such cause. In recent use, influenced by sense 3A and used especially in negative contexts, frequently as object of, to have. This catches a lot of what the quarrel with others, as Yeats puts it, might mean. But how far does any of it answer to what Yeats calls the quarrel with ourselves? It may be that the word here straddles two quite different kinds of disagreement or two distinct fields of combative engagement. But the main force of Yeats's use of quarrel is one of surprise. Surprise that a word from the aggressive contentions of a public arena should be applied to something as apparently inward-looking as poetry and to something as seemingly private as the self. Inclined as Yeats may have been to view himself later as one of the last romantics, there's little that's conventionally romantic about this. The feel of Wordsworth's definition of poetry as emotion recollected in tranquility is far from the kind of turmoil envisaged here. It's far too from what passes for the truth now, almost a century after Yeats made his formulation. so much so that it's entirely plausible in contemporary poetic and critical culture to replace quarrel with the word agreement. Nowadays, we make out of the agreement with others rhetoric, but of the agreement with ourselves poetry. Most of what I want to say at present concerns poetry, but that will have to be said in the medium of critical prose, of rhetoric, if you like. And so it may be useful to cast a glance at the kind of writing that concerns itself critically with poetry. Here, I think, agreement is the common currency. Not only is there an underlying consensus about fundamental things, but even a consensus about the positive value of consensus itself. Partly that can be accounted for by the enormous changes which affected critical discussion through the 20th century, the most significant of those being the emergence of professional academic criticism, that vast acreage of words published to be consumed in passing by a few assessors and dispensers of patronage, and destined to lose even this tiny audience in a very short time. Here, while there may be 100 methods of jockeying for position, along with the wholly honourable presentation of genuinely new information, there's really little room for any thoroughgoing rejection of what is taken for granted by those who have themselves the power to grant things. Any powerful consensus does not feel the need to formulate itself. And the more powerful it is, the less need there will be. Perhaps even so, the dimensions of a consensus in contemporary criticism may be estimated with reference to what's now plainly beyond the pale. Take, for example, T.S. Eliot's definition of criticism, made in 1923, as, roughly speaking, the elucidation of works of art and the correction of taste. One test of that in our contemporary conditions would be to ask whether it would or would not be regarded as fit to publish in an academic context. The red pencils of how many peer reviewers would hover over it, ready to strike. The statement in itself would be seen generally as objectionable, because clearly spoiling for a fight, and the key terms would be exposed as either false or out of date. In the large field of endeavour that identifies itself as humanities, for instance, an unself-conscious belief in things called works of art would be understood as a sign of, at best, undereducated naivety. Elucidation would be marked down as something epistemologically far too sure of itself, and taste identified as a category insufficiently historicised or theorised, while any notion of correction would be enough to consign the piece to the netherworld of outright rejection. Who, it might be asked, appealing implicitly to the consensus of upright fellow members of the guild, does the author of such remarks think he is? Actually, the T.S. Eliot of 1923 was trying to stir things up and hoping for a productive degree of unacceptability even then. And his essay, which bore the archly neo-Arnoldian title of The Function of Criticism, affected to disdain the ruck of raised and squabbling voices floating above them like a sublimely untroubled hot air balloon. This is Eliot. But on giving the matter a little attention, we perceive that criticism, far from being a simple and orderly field of beneficent activity from which impostors can be readily ejected, is no better than a Sunday park of contending and contentious orators who have not even arrived at the articulation of their differences. Here, one would suppose, was a place for quiet cooperative labour, The critic, one would suppose, if he is to justify his existence, should endeavour to discipline his personal prejudices and cranks, tares to which we're all subject, and compose his differences with as many of his fellows as possible in the common pursuit of true judgment. When we find that quite the contrary prevails, we begin to suspect that the critic owes his livelihood to the violence and extremity of his opposition to other critics, or else to some trifling oddities of his own with which he contrives to season the opinions which men already hold, and which, out of vanity or sloth, they prefer to maintain. We are tempted to expel the lot. No vulgar quarrelling here, Eliot seems to protest, in this atmosphere so pointedly distinct from any violence and extremity. And yet, the entire passage is, while acute and witty, also at least abrasive, if not downright rude. In tone, it's nothing if not quarrelsome. Somehow, what claims to be an appeal for consensus is pitched emphatically against the conditions of consensual discussion. Avoiding arguments is, of course, another defining characteristic of the presently dominant consensus when it comes to things like the criticism of poetry. In this, there are two principal and complementary patterns of behaviour. The first is a commitment to praise, to positive value judgments wherever possible, and indeed even wherever challenging. In this respect, the ideal is to be as near as achievable an indiscriminately positive appreciator of poets. The second is to meet any difficult and non-consensual arguments with silence. Knowing whom not to engage with is just as important as knowing whom to praise. These rules apply most obviously to the critical discussion in and around what is called the poetry world, but they apply also differently inflected to the realm of academic discourse. Here too, quarrels need to be avoided like the plague. And in place of positive evaluation, there's a wholeheartedly passive receptiveness to those other academic writers judged to be the current key players in a discipline, who must be honoured by regular citation and whose areas of interest must be accepted without question as being important. Those areas are not all necessarily literary by any means, though the academic currency of particular authors does fluctuate and needs to be watched attentively. Many are broadly historical, cultural, and political. In relation to these, no young academic can afford to question current market valuations, nor is she or he in the slightest to be blamed for their needful caution. Yet the effect over time is a baleful one. For the possibility of proper critical discussion within the forum of specifically academic and professional discourse becomes more and more constrained, to the point at which it disappears altogether. Concentration and constraint have been going on for a long time. But where we now have a relationship of mutual esteem between poets and their critics, or more accurately, in a lot of cases, between poet critics and critic poets, who frequently coexist in the same person, there was once a wariness and a measure of real distrust. In 1963, Elizabeth Bishop could write to Robert Lowell about a recently published critical symposium on his work Skunk Hour, registering the unwelcome effects of the then dominant models of critical attention to poetry, which were on display. "Oh dear," she wrote, "I do loathe explanations, etc. And it seems to me a symposium should do more or less, something quite different at any rate. All this explaining should mostly go without saying, I think. And yet, that is what people ask for. To hell with explainers. that's really why I don't want to teach. The fact that Bishop did end up having to teach shouldn't lessen the force of this. Indeed, it may even make that force more interesting for us. And her own critical powers are revealed in the same letter, with a few lines on Skunk Hour that easily surpass anything written about that poem before or since. It has so much life, it has so much more life to it than you'd ever guess from those essays, she writes, and so much wonderful, distant, slightly hesitant, but nevertheless sure as a hymn, kind of northern music to it. Yet amid all the noise of the tenured explainers, the professors and the poet critics and the critic poets at work here, there and everywhere in the booming university system that makes good money from the humanities, Bishop knows exactly what is never being mentioned. She goes on, "The trouble is, excuse my clichés, as people grow older, non-artists, that is, they do have to steel themselves so much, forget so much, and try to pretend that everything's all right so much. They're afraid, probably rightly, that poetry, any art, if they take it hard, might upset them. So they pretend they like it, while at the same time, they resist it absolutely." 52 years later, this is one of those truths which remains unsayable. To air it now, whenever, say, yet another anthology makes its marketing pitch on the promise that poetry can change your life for the better, would be understood simply as quarrelsome, the work of an elitist, a spoiler, or, at best and condescendingly, a useful gadfly. Yet, it's a great poet, and writing to another great poet, I myself think that it's absolutely true. There's a venerable quarrel, as we know, between poetry and intellectual abstraction. Ironically, the quarrel itself can fuel more poetry. One instance from a thousand is in John Keats's Lamia. "Do not all charms fly at the mere touch of cold philosophy? There was an awful rainbow once in heaven. We know her woof, her texture. She is given in the dull catalogue of common things. Philosophy will clip an angel's wings, conquer all mysteries by rule and line, empty the haunted air, the nomad mine, unweave a rainbow, as it erstwhile made the tender person Lamia melt into a shade." Now, this is much less grown up, you might say, than Bishop, but the fact that added intellectual maturity would ruin it is really just one way of noticing the power and authenticity of its perspective. And the narrative of Lamia as a whole, we should remember, is rather more circumspect on these very issues. Nevertheless, cold philosophy is always ready with its wing clippers whenever academic criticism takes stock of poetry. And just because the philosophical assumptions of Keats's time have changed, we should not assume that the imperatives of institutionalized knowledge have put those clippers away. On the one hand, poetry of powerful plenty of powerful interests know what it is the business of poetry to be doing. On the other, reciprocally, there's no shortage of poets who look to those interests in order to learn what it is that they should do. Luckily for all concerned, there's no quarrel about this, for all sides are happy to be in underlying agreement. Yet the contemporary academy is intellectually constrained and directed to a degree that far outdoes anything prevailing in Bishop's time. It's important to say that there are wholly beneficial consequences of academic professionalism, too many to list here. Over the last 50 years, too, the Academy has been the breeding ground and practical enabler of some permanently valuable scholarly and critical contributions to the way we know and think about poetry. Its authority also has been used for good purposes. Nothing is objectionable about a system of intellectual discipline, which results, for example, in Shakespeare deniers finding themselves shut out by respectable publishers, or the blatantly perverse being driven to revalue writers who were never much valued in the first place, only to a few friends in the pub. Exclusion can be a good thing. Even so, there's been for some time a state of affairs in which whole swathes of subject attention and critical method are either devalued or declared inappropriate to present needs and are thus rendered off limits. A profession needs a governing narrative to explain itself to the world, and for literary academia, that narrative has become one of progress. As though critical appreciation were on a par with truly progressive kinds of knowledge, such as the sciences. But who decides what progress looks like? And how can something as definite as progress be a quarrel? Professional power exercises itself by being thoroughly conflict-averse. This requires consensus. And it's of the essence that consensus need not speak its name. Simply, consensus is what everyone knows without having to say so. In the contemporary academy, everyone, that is to say everyone in positions of substantial institutional disciplinary power, knows that literary criticism can only exist under sufferance of various kinds. It should be able and willing to historicise itself, relate itself to another approved field of attention, political, cultural, gender-based, psychological, philosophical, even medical, and generally prove amenable to translation into terms other than its own. Everyone knows, too, that the study of authors has progressed beyond what was once thought of as a canon, that what was formerly known and valued must now be interrogated, and searched for ideological goods which mostly it never possessed, and that busy stocktaking of all possible academic activity, however minor, on a given topic in the last few years, counts for more than serious consideration and elucidation of work from 10, 20, or even 100 years ago. The most polished and professional work in academic criticism is generally assumed to be that which is most up to date, most closely attuned to the unspoken consensus of the day, and most nearly, in intellectual terms, empty. Everybody who is anybody in academia knows all this, but they do not say it, because there's never any need for them to do so. Saying it, doubtless, would simply appall them, and would be treated as a lapse in taste, when in truth, it's more in the nature of a breach in protocol. In some ways, as far as literary criticism's interests are concerned, this does not greatly matter. Art may not need to bother its head with the opinions of professors in the humanities, and there are an awful lot of these in the world, for very much longer. Already, almost nobody is listening, and before long, few will be willing to make the investment. As students or as apprentices in the increasingly ramshackle system itself, in finding out. The currently cried up crisis in the humanities is also, to co-opt another phrase of Yeats's, one of those catch cries of the clown that amounts in the long run to little more than the squealing of various interests as they vest themselves a little deeper in the shallow politics of their time. In truth, the humanities were in crisis long ago, a crisis of self-belief, in fact, which was most obviously enacted in the advent of so-called theory and literature departments in the 1980s, and their heart buckled and failed under the pressure of that doubt. Since then, theory may have lost a good deal of its luster, but it's fair to say that the non-literary has set the terms for much of what passes as professional literary study, and by now it commands all the powers of patronage that can guarantee its complete victory. How else can it be, for instance, that projects announcing themselves as interdisciplinary routinely attract special funding from those bodies whose opinion matters to university managers, as though it were somehow more advanced, more definitely progressing than purely disciplinary study? It is indeed progressing somewhere. It is progressing decisively away from literary criticism. In the process, it may actually put an end to various purely disciplinary areas. Perhaps this is just as well, for criticism's involvement with academe has never been entirely a happy one, and is in any case not of very long standing in historical terms. Great poetry was written long before there were professors to study it, and there's no reason at all to believe that it requires them in order to happen again in the future. Universities will increasingly find themselves obliged to avoid activities that are essentially disinterested ones, and the humanities, who have decided for some time that their studies could not on any account be disinterested, must expect to have their interests presented to them by those whose money pays the bills. True, many in the humanities dislike the politics of these newly imperious interests, but the essential point, that scholars were to be like Yeats's rhetoricians, who are motivated by the crowd they have won or may win, was conceded by the Academy itself, emphatically and ruthlessly, long ago. All of this, at least, leaves the field clear for criticism to do its job. A job not all that different from the description offered by Matthew Arnold in 1869, when he claimed that the task of his book, Culture and Anarchy, was to recommend it as the great help out of our present difficulties, culture being a pursuit of our total perfection by means of getting to know on all the matters which most concern us the best, which has been thought and said in the world, and through this knowledge turning a stream of fresh and free thought upon our stock notions and habits, which we now follow staunchly but mechanically. Once professional learning has been systematized and reduced to nothing more than a set of stock notions and habits, fresh and free thought must make its home elsewhere. One must not suppose, though, that fresh and free thought is ever welcomed by or accommodating to the dominant power structures of its time. Certainly, freshness and freedom have long been lacking from the major humanities disciplines. On both sides of the Atlantic, the humanities may be making a lot of pain and noise at present, but the essence of their complaint is that they're not loved enough. It would seem never to have occurred to the most vocal mourners that their disciplines did not come into being in order that they should be loved, nor indeed that the society from whose instinctive values, including the values that attach to tradition and to art, they have declared themselves so completely apart from, and to which they remain so insistently superior, has truly no obligation to offer them its affection. When what were once disciplines of thought and study, conceived and practiced in terms of disinterested knowledge, decide that their success is measured by prestige, peers and patronage, and that their prime task is to interrogate their own past, along with the past and the present of their fostering societies, and the fundamental shared values of aesthetic, social and civil traditions, then they have no right to be surprised when those who foot the bill tire of their interrogations and ask some hard questions of their own. Perhaps the lesson to be drawn from this is that quarrels need to be wisely chosen. The quarrel with others that Yeats calls rhetoric is not a thing from which he himself can claim to be a part. And from early until late in his writing career, he knowingly entered and instigated quarrels with a fully rhetorical commitment. But the quarrel with ourselves that he identifies with poetry is not something merely quarrelsome, not just the picking of public fights. Ideally for Yeats, and we should remember that all good poetry can imagine, though no poetry can actually achieve a state of ideal perfection, the purest quarrels are the most nearly disinterested ones. And it's these which can bring energy into the writing of verse. Just before the composition of Pyramica, Silentia Lunae, Yeats published his poem On Woman, which is less praise of femininity than an aspiration towards it. May God be praised for woman that gives up all her mind. A man may find in no man a friendship of her kind that covers all he has brought as with her flesh and bone, nor quarrels with a thought because it is not her own. Obviously, there are dynamics of gendered imagination at work here which would be foolish to deny, but for now it'd be worth concentrating on the opposition which is being set up in these lines between friendship and quarrel, and the way in which this is related to what Yeats calls thought. It may be that thought is one thing, the only thing perhaps, which poetry and rhetoric have as a common property, but what they do with it is entirely different. For Yeats, we need to remember, each was still a kind of quarrel. Man's work, to return to the gendered terms of that poem. In 1916-17, around the same time as both the poem On Woman and Per Amica's composition, Yeats was attempting a prose autobiography. Here, the ability to cover thought as with flesh and bone, that apparently quintessential female power, is attributed to none other than Yeats's sometime flatmate, Arthur Symonds. Here's Yeats in his attempted autobiography. That night at 12 o'clock, I said to Symonds, who had just come in, "Did I ever tell you about Maud gone?" Until 2 or 3 in the morning, I spoke of my love for her. Must have been quite an evening. Of all the men I have known, he was the best listener. He could listen as a woman listens, never meeting one's thought as a man does with a rival thought, but taking up what one had said and changing it, giving it, as it were, flesh and bone. The thoughts here clearly run into the poem, whose ideal of sympathy as against quarrel finds the same metaphor of flesh and bone giving its covering to thought. But Yeats knows better than to think that he can find poetry in this provision of bodily form, however much it may be needed and desired. Sex is at issue here, undoubtedly, and one thing that Yeats is asking himself at this point is whether sex, even with Maud gone, is enough to still the quarrelsome impetus from and in poetry. Though the prose memoir names Maud, "All my old love had returned," he writes, the poem opts instead of Maud for Solomon and the Queen of Sheba. Though pedantry denies, it's plain the Bible means that Solomon grew wise while talking with his queens, yet never could, although they say he counted grass, count all the praises due when Sheba was his lass, when she the iron wrought, or when from the smithy fire it shuddered in the water, harshness of their desire that made them stretch and yawn, pleasure that comes with sleep, shudder that made them one. That shudder which prefigures the climactic and catastrophic shudder in the loins of Yeats's later poem, The Leader and the Swan, is also here the shudder in water of newly made iron, a made thing. And Per Amica's remarks on poetry retrace this uncertain border between the erotic and the fabricated with the same word. Remember? Unlike the rhetoricians who get a confident voice from remembering the crowd they have won or may win, we sing amid our uncertainty and smitten, even in the presence of the most high beauty, by the knowledge of our solitude, our rhythm shudders. One notion which can be taken from this is the idea of made art as something that registers a deep unease, along with an unstoppable compulsion in its very making. That is, ourselves would doubtless be happier and more fortunate generally if not in a state of quarrelling. But art requires that quarrel which comes from the profoundest self-confrontation of the art in the artist. And for Yeats, this means that poetry takes the heat of the known self into the coldness of the unknown, which is also the coldness of a made form. In lit statements, this has a distinctly rhetorical spin, as though it were by now a brazenly self-aware quarrel with others, as perhaps it is. And indeed, in sentences like these from 1937, it seems to be a quarrel with us too. "Because I need a passionate syntax," Yeats says, "for passionate subject matter, I compel myself to accept those traditional meters that have developed with the language. Ezra Pound, Turner, Lawrence wrote admirable free verse. I could not. I would lose myself, become joyless. All that is personal soon rots. It must be packed in ice or salt. If I wrote a personal love or sorrow in free verse or in any rhythm that left it unchanged amid all its accident, I would be full of self-contempt because of my egotism and indiscretion, and I foresee the boredom of my reader. I must choose a traditional stanza. Even what I alter must seem traditional. Talk to me of originality, and I will turn on you with rage. I am a crowd. I am a lonely man. I am nothing. Ancient salt is best packing." With the many things that may be said about this, I'll content myself here with just the one. Yeats is utterly, utterly at odds with much of our own received wisdom about both self and form in poetry, damning not only the poets and critics who believe that freedom of form equates with a desirable freedom of personal expression, but also those poets and critics who think that form is something simply there to be used, like an item in a toolbox. Today, many poets still think of themselves approvingly as members of a crowd, with politics and cultural correctness on full display. And others still announce themselves as lonely men and women, with their lives and family histories, however humdrum, as all-engrossing subjects. Fewer, many fewer, are serious about being nothing. Only Yeats in his time, and only Yeats in ours, can honestly say all three. I am a crowd. I am a lonely man. I am nothing. But earlier than 1937, it was Yeats's poetry which told the truest story about the pain of a quarrel with the self, a pain which the later statements, haughty and magnificent as they are too rhetorical to register in full. It's not that the pain is somehow put into verse through the agency of form. Rather, the pain is there, fierce and unbudgeable, deep in the form itself. It's there in the sixth stanza of a prayer for my daughter. May she become a flourishing hidden tree, that all her thoughts may like the linnet be, and have no business but dispensing round their magnanimities of song, nor but in merriment begin a chase, nor but in merriment a quarrel. Or may she live like some green laurel, rooted in one dear perpetual place. From its first publication in 1891 until its 15th collected outing in 1923, the first line of Yeats's poem The Sorrow of Love had spoken of the quarrel of the sparrows in the eaves. At first sight, the linnet in A Prayer for My Daughter is related to those sparrows, with both chase and quarrel, apparently in the realm of merriment. But the older Yeats knows that a quarrel can go far beyond merriment. In 1924, The Sorrow of Love begins with the brawling of a sparrow in the eaves, keeping for quarrel the deeper resonances of A Prayer for My Daughter. Those resonances are partly with earlier work, such as On Woman, but largely they sound in the rhyme, quarrel, laurel. The laurel is, of course, one of the oldest conventional emblems of poetry, or of the condition of being a poet. And for Yeats here, it has to come face to face with its rhyme, in quarrel. An early draft, in fact, of the lines gives this confrontation a less figurative cast. When eyes upon a promised face, with present faces quarrel, oh, let her live like some green laurel that's rooted in one dear perpetual place. Quarrels that are face to face, and are even in some ways about the faces we wear in the world, are the worst, and they're both apart from poetry and a part of it, just as one word and another word in rhyme are both detached from and attached to one another. The poet's laurel, in which Yeats unconditionally believes, is always intimate with the quarrel behind and within the poetry. From all of this, it follows that poetry and criticism, like Yeats's poetry and rhetoric, are mutually involved and involving. If they can have a successful relation, that is not to be achieved without other, sometimes disastrous or destructive, modes of interaction. You cannot just decide that the relationship has to work and declare that it can do so without risk. And yet this is what much criticism in the literary sphere, and not necessarily just academic writing, believes that it can achieve. Contemporary verse floats in a thin soup of indiscriminate, that is to say, undiscriminating, praise and esteem. The unspoken cultural consensus here is one which values respect above all, and to make actual discriminations between, say, good and less good poetry is to deny verse the respect which is somehow its due. When the difference between texts and personality is hard to make, as it generally is now, the respect to which we rightly believe ourselves entitled as people extends to the reception being accorded to our texts. But a printed text has no automatic right to respect, and all of the respect accorded to it needs to be earned. In the contemporary literary world, it's as though reviewers received new slim volumes with the same sticker on every cover, one which asks simply, "Do you know who I am?" The poetry comes, as it were, from a place of certainty and identity, an imaginative region untroubled by any quarrels it hasn't already won. And it's to be received without quarrel. Above all, nothing in the process should shudder. The success of the poetry must find a smooth match in the appreciativeness of its reception, and the issues in the poetry, issues which it is likely to be hailed as expressing, or even perhaps using poetry in order to express, must be ones which a dominant cultural consensus holds to be worthwhile. We're still, in other words, a long way behind the Yeats of a century ago. In some respects, that isn't the least surprising, and the situation is not one to be rectified by some presumptuous and short-sighted proposal that poets and critics should get their acts together and follow his lead. Go thou, as Louis MacNeice advised in this context, as long ago as 1941, and do otherwise. And that is still the right course to take. But poetry, nevertheless, has to remember how to quarrel with itself, just as criticism needs to rediscover the power to criticise. A poet's job is to make things, and a critic's task is partly to offer correction. But real making is essential, and real correction. Anything that keys itself to external standards, that lives by a supposedly life-giving consensus beyond art, or at any rate a livelihood-granting one, is not real poetry and not real criticism. Both things, under such conditions, become passive agents of their time and mere expressions of a zeitgeist, that vacuous but ravenous abstraction in which so much cultural prestige still seems to reside. Against both, we must assert the continued relevance of Yeats's Ice and Salt, and indeed the continued relevance of Yeats himself. We must not be surprised to be called quarrelsome, but at least we will not knowingly have clipped an angel's wing. Thanks very much.
Peter, and thank you very much, audience. The thanks are not over to you, because we have drinks for you there, and we have magazines for you here. Do feel free to take a copy of PN Review, and also feel free, of course, to subscribe to it. But let us give a final round of applause to our lecturer, and come and join us for some drinks.